right, all right. Welcome to the Michael Slate Show. I'm your host, Michael Slate, full of energy, tension, all kinds of things. It's just that invigorating ride, all right? All kinds of things today, that invigorating ride. That's what it gets. We won't even get into it anymore, all right? I want to welcome you to the show and back end of the show, just to let you know what's coming up at the back end of the show. We are going to be talking with members of the Yes Men, Yes Man Mike Bonanno, and the director of a brand new film about the Yes Men called The Yes Men Are Revolting, Laura Nix. And Laura is also part of the Yes Men group, their collective as well. And we'll be talking with them about their latest shenanigans, all right, and what's going on with them. Before that, we will be talking with Carl Dix from the Revolutionary Communist Party and co-founder of the Stop Mass Incarceration Network. We're going to be talking about a mass mobilization called for this coming October in New York City, where they're expecting to get 100,000 or more people from all over the country coming and saying, we will not tolerate what is being done to black and brown people today at the hands of the police and in this entire society, all of the genocidal thing that's just banging at the doors of this society, all right? So we're going to be talking with Carl at the second segment of the show. But opening the show up, I'm very pleased to be welcoming to the show, back to the show, Orpheus Reed. Orpheus is a writer for Revolution Newspaper, and he's been writing a lot. He's been talking a lot about drilling for oil in the Arctic. That's what he's going to talk with us about today, and why the U.S. is determined to continue this dangerous course. Orpheus, welcome to the show.
Hey, great to be on, Michael. Thanks.
Sure, man. Well, let's jump into this because, you know, this question of the Arctic is a huge question for so many people right now, as well it should be. It's one that if it wasn't a huge question, I would be even more worried than I am right now. But, there's a whole lot of people that have a different, you know, view of what's going on and how to deal with this. And I want to start with you by asking you to explain explain what's the situation in the Arctic. What are the things that are at issue here?
Well, there's really big issues. First of all, there's the whole issue of the real danger of an oil spill in that region. And this is where Shell is going to start drilling is in the Chukchi Sea, which is one of the last pristine ocean environments in the world, right? This is just like incredibly rich marine life. There's a whole basically ecosystem there that the Inupiat people, the indigenous people of the region, survive on and have for thousands of years. So this is really threatened by oil drilling in the Arctic. And further, there's the whole issue really of even a huger issue of climate change right now. Scientists, there was a major study in Nature magazine, which is one of the leading scientific journals this year, that said in order for the world to stay below 2 degrees Celsius change in world temperature, right, which is greater than 2 degrees really is considered basically a catastrophe, right? So to stay below that, it says that no oil reserves in the Arctic can be essentially burned. And so here you have Shell Oil, and you have not just Shell, but all these other companies kind of waiting in line. And then also these other world powers just vying to get into the Arctic to start exploiting it. So first, this system basically has melted the Arctic, is leading to devastation in that region and devastation in the world ecosystems. Now they're seizing on this opportunity to get in there and grab what they see as a great strategic prize. So there's really a lot on the line for the, for the whole ecosystems of the planet and the people.
Yeah. Now, listen, one of the things, I want to go back a little bit just so people understand. So Shell Oil is actually, right. they tried to start drilling, a couple years ago or a year ago?
And
2012, right. Okay. They tried to start drilling then, and it was a harbinger of what's to come, perhaps, where they weren't very successful in what they were doing. And let's talk about that, because Shell Oil has actually, they've applied for the right to drill there. They've actually painted themselves as very, very conscious about the dangers and threats to the environment, and they're taking all kinds of steps to prevent anything bad happening. And Obama has jumped on their wagon and started cheering and screaming and allowing them to do it. Let's talk about that a little bit. What's actually happening there?
It's an interesting history. There's actually a major article in the New York Times talking about some of the history of this. And what it ran down is that Shell basically jumped on Obama's bandwagon early on, and they decided that they were going to package themselves kind of with his approach to the environment of, like, we care about climate change, we know it's a real issue, and package themselves as an eco-friendly company. And now we should remember, this is the company that was all tied up in and is a major player in Nigeria, where there have been horrendous oil spills year after year after year. And also Shell has worked closely with Nigerian government in attacking the Ogoni people, including the case where 9 Ogoni leaders were actually set up by the Nigerian government on charges and were executed, Ken Saro-Wiwa and so forth. So Shell was intimately tied up and a major player in this whole situation. So that's their history. But in terms of the Arctic, they've packaged themselves as kind of eco-friendly. They actually sometimes send their representatives to chew whale meat with the indigenous people up there. And this is all part of a strategy to really put themselves in position to seize hold of this strategic prize. And in terms of Obama, it's interesting. Another thing this article pointed out was that Obama, very early on, even just directly in the wake of the Gulf oil spill, was just anxious to get the U.S. into the Arctic and to open up drilling there. And they, I mean, this is really driven by a whole thing of seeing the Arctic as like one of the last great strategic prizes that all of these world powers have to get a hold of. So that's kind of what's going on with that. And they do have a history. Shell was up there in 2012 and basically had a series of fiascos, one after the other. I mean, one of their oil rigs ran aground. Another one almost ran aground. One of them caught on fire. One of their contractors was cited for all these violations for polluting the ocean, et cetera. So this is their history. And sort of despite all these things, right, Obama has, as this article said, has green-lighted, it didn't say green-lighted, but basically he cleared the path for Shell to move through the kind of fractious federal regulatory bureaucracy to allow them to get these permits to drill in the Arctic.
Mm-hmm. Now, the thing is when you were talking about all the stuff that Shell was doing, and the history is really very important. I mean, the problem here is, you know, you have one, just the reality, the truth. If you're going to get down to the truth and go beyond what they're saying, they actually are, number six in terms of the top companies most responsible for producing greenhouse emissions throughout history. This is not like they didn't just like come onto the scene and say, hey, you know, we can do better. But these people are actually number six in thing, you know, which is that's a fairly elite company to be keeping, and they're doing quite a bit of damage. And like the point about in 2012, there was all kinds of things that showed even, well, put it this way, even Obama signing this thing and his own people telling him that if Shell is given permission to drill in the Arctic, there's a 75% chance that there'll be an oil spill. And you think about that, and you think about what happened to them in 2012 as they were getting their rigs ready and all this other stuff. This is a very dangerous situation for humanity.
Oh, extremely dangerous. No matter what they say, I mean, let's remember, every time that these oil companies do this and every time the whole system backs them up to do it, they claim that they can do it safely, right? And this is heard over and over again. Well, we've learned from the last disaster, we can do it safely. And every single time, it's not happened. I mean, they said this before the Exxon Valdez, right? They said it before the oil spill in the Gulf of Mexico, and now they're saying it again in the Arctic. And it's true, the Bureau of Ocean Energy Management, which opened this up, you know, officially allowed Shell to go ahead and do it. Their own study says that 75% chance of an oil spill over the life of a lease. And at the same time, they put out, well, we're taking a thoughtful and careful approach to allowing this. So it's just crap. You know, it's just crap what they're saying. This cannot be done safely. It's extremely dangerous drilling in the Arctic, extremely rough conditions, extreme weather, storms. You have ice 6 months of the year, a very short window for drilling and all this. And further, there's a deeper thing that these companies are not driven by, you know, sort of the needs of the environment, the needs of humanity. They're driven by really profitability and rushing in to grab and compete with other companies and get a hold of this, these rich reserves before some other company does it. So environmental protections and plans and all these things they're supposed to have in place is just kind of an annoyance that they have to deal with and kind of move their way around. And they're not coming from, they're not planning it based on the needs of the ecosystems at all. Mm-hmm. And they can't, you know, mm-hmm. more fundamentally, they can't do this.
I'm going to get into that with you in just a couple minutes, but I wanted to ask you this, just a little bit more follow-up on this thing, because you mentioned earlier about the Nature magazine study and what it showed about the catastrophe that it would bring on. And it was a study that showed that in order to prevent global temperatures from rising above 2 degrees Celsius, which would bring on a catastrophe, one-third of all oil reserves, one-half of all gas reserves, and 80% of coal reserves would have to remain unused. And it also showed that developing fossil fuels in the Arctic or increasing unconventional oil production would, in fact, make it impossible. Let's say that again. Would make it impossible to limit global warming to 2 degrees Celsius. But, you know, who cares what these guys said? They sit around with pointy hats and, you know, look in test tubes all day. They don't really know what they're talking about, right?
Well, these are people who are the world's leading climatologists in the world. So this has been studied scientifically, right? And we have to, if we want to really understand how the world works, we got to look at the science. We got to look at reality, right? And so these scientists are telling us what the reality is, and this has been deeply looked at and so forth. And we're already seeing tremendous changes from climate change all over the world, more extreme weather, right, the melting Arctic, which is actually regulates the whole world ecosystem in many ways, right? We're seeing rising seas. We're seeing tremendous changes in the ocean. I mean, there's mass migrations in the oceans of species, right? All kinds of horrible environmental things are being brought on by this system. So, yes, this is reality, you know, what these climatologists are saying. We're already seeing, even with the amount of change in temperature, which I think is somewhere around 1 degree Celsius at this point, we've already seen massive changes, right? And 2 degrees more will be catastrophic if this happens. And so they've actually done a scientific study, and they've looked at how much oil is in the Arctic. They've looked at how much oil is in reserves and so forth. And it's a pretty straightforward calculation of, like, if this amount is burned, this amount of CO2 is produced, and this amount of temperature increase goes along with that. So this is based on what's really true. Mm-hmm. We've got to look at that, and we've got to act based on understanding that. You can't just sit and wait for something horrible to happen when something horrible is already happening and you know there's a whole direction that things are moving.
Let me remind listeners that you're tuned into the Michael Slate Show, and we're talking today with Orpheus Reed, a writer for Revolution Newspaper, who covers things like the oil drilling in the Arctic and the environment for Revolution Newspaper. Orpheus, tell me this. We'll just do one more thing on this because it really drove me crazy just reading about all this in the past and revisiting it last night. You mentioned the Exxon Valdez. I want people to get a sense of, like, if you can give us any sense of the particularities of what happens if Shell Oil just loses it all, or they have the same kind of thing that broke down in the Gulf of Mexico a couple years ago. You mentioned the Exxon Valdez. Even just there were tremendous repercussions. There were actual concrete impacts on whole species of animals that and the environment itself. It just, things changed dramatically. And that was something that at the time was probably one of the biggest things that ever happened. But then you think about what the potential is with this Shell Oil thing in the Arctic. When we talk about catastrophe, just give people a condensed idea of what you're talking about in terms of catastrophe.
Yeah, I mean, the Chukchi Sea, as I said, is one of the most pristine, productive ocean ecosystems that are left on the planet. It's got, you're talking about an ecosystem of polar bears, walruses, whales, many species of seabirds, all kinds of seals, and then this whole, all of this life is dependent on the sea ice and kind of the organisms that thrive there in relation to it. And then you do have a whole culture of indigenous people in that region that harvest life from the sea, that sustain their whole way of life. For thousands and thousands of years, they've been dependent on this. So a major oil spill in this region, I mean, the Exxon Valdez caused tremendous damage to the ecosystem in Alaska, right? You had a huge impact on the herring population, which is one of the foundations, one of the keystone species that supported all the life in that region, right? It's never really rebounded in the same kind of way. I mean, I read a book actually about a whole family of orcas that live in that region that basically many, many members of that family were killed off as a result of the Exxon oil spill. And this family is now headed for extinction. So you have extinction of species on the line. You have tremendous damage to the environment simply from the oil spill and the danger of oil spill. And the thing is, oil spills in the Arctic would be incredibly difficult, if not impossible, to clean up, mm-hmm. right? I mean, the closest Coast Guard station, I think, is 1,000 miles away from where they're actually located. Right, and then you have these extremely harsh conditions, and then you have these oil companies that are not even prepared and not even really able to prepare for the conditions to clean this up. And even ocean oil spills that happen, right, I think the figure is that whenever oil is spilled in the ocean, the most it gets cleaned up is 10 to 15% of that oil. So a major oil spill in this region would just be catastrophic. It's really maddening to see this. It's maddening to see, with all the damage, all the destruction of the environment going on, that here they are going to one of the last productive regions, right? The last fairly pristine regions, and now they're threatening that too.
Let me remind listeners that you're tuned into the Michael Slate Show, and we're talking today with Orpheus Reed, a writer for Revolution Newspaper, who covers things like the oil drilling in the Arctic and the environment for Revolution Newspaper. Now, let me ask you this, Orpheus. I know we have just a limited amount of time. We have 5 minutes, and I got two more questions for you.
Okay.
The first one is, again, everything you've told us about. So why the hell are they so relentless? Why is it that they go after the oil like this?
Well, you know, this system of capitalism does not make decisions based on what the needs of the environment are. I mean, a lot of environmentalists looked at this and they said it was just inexplicable. You know, why is Obama doing this? And the thing is that this system of capitalism cannot stand aside from what they see here. And they see in the Arctic as much as something like 22% of the world's remaining undiscovered oil and also huge quantities of natural gas, right? So there's a question of sea shipping lanes, which through the melting is opening up. This is extremely profitable to be controlling these sea shipping lanes. So there's tremendous competition from all these capitalist powers who are just driven by profitability, who are driven with the need to seize this before someone else does, some other power does, right? And so they're just going for it. They're seeing this as a big opportunity for them to get in there and control this. And there's been all sorts of studies from the U.S., including the military, about the importance and the need to not just sort of economically for the U.S. to get their foothold in there, but also for them to be able to project power in this region, to really be the ones to decide what happens, who gets what, and basically to regulate all the relations up there. And this is kind of a source of increasing competition between all the powers that are located in the Arctic, Russia, Canada, Denmark to some degree. And then there's other powers that are also racing to try to get in there.
Yeah, definitely. That's a very heavy point there, man. Let me ask you this. There's also a struggle that's been building up around this. I want to ask you sort of a combined question. Tell us a little bit about the struggle that has been building. It's very important. It seems to me that everybody know about that and, you know, figure out the ways they can relate to it. But also, what's it going to take, in your view, to actually stop this?
Yeah, I think it's very important, the struggle that's gone on. I mean, in Seattle, there's been all kinds of actions by what they call kayaktivists who are out in the water, and they're like out there paddling right in front of this towering oil rig that goes almost like a football field up above them. They're on the water, been trying to block this. The Polar Pioneer rig just pulled out of Seattle this past week, right? And you had kayaktivists on the water who got out on the water, refused to move, and other ones who came out and backed them up in different ways. And they're being gone after by the Coast Guard, basically, and arrested for violating the safety zone of the oil drilling rig. I mean, here you have an oil drilling rig that's violating the safety of the entire planet, and they are arresting protesters for trying to stop it, right, because it's violating this rig safety zone. It's really criminal, you know, what's been happening. But there has been this very important resistance. There's been all kinds of actions. People have demonstrated at the terminal where this Polar Pioneer drilling rig was located, attempted to shut down the terminal. There have been activists who have suspended themselves from anchor chains of different ships in this region. Shell has kind of a whole fleet of different ships in different places in Washington state. So all over the place, there have been these actions that have happened. Some of them have involved hundreds and hundreds of people. And I think it's really important that this has happened, that it be popularized. And it really needs to spread. You know, people are continuing these actions. The rigs have left now from here. I mean, I think there's still a rig that's up in Everett, Washington, that's going to be the target of more protests. But it's very important that people know this. But I think there's also really a question of the importance of people grappling with what are we dealing with here. You know, I mean, it's still not uncommon to hear people say, well, it's not, including major environmentalists, to say it's not too late for Obama to change his mind on the Arctic. And the point is, people are not really enough seriously grappling with why is Obama really compelled, and why is it, you know, even more than Obama, why is the system really compelled to drill in the Arctic? And you know, really be grappling and struggling over this question of what's forcing them to do this, and also what is the problem and what's the solution that we're up against. So there needs to be much more of that. And on that basis, I think, or along with that, there really needs to be a massive resistance, a real call to masses of people to get out there and to get involved in this, because it's going to take really mass determined resistance to go up this. And ultimately, it's going to take a revolution to deal with this environmental emergency, to have a whole new system that is not based on destroying the planet, that's not exploiting and using humanity, but really is about freeing humanity, emancipating humanity, and protecting the ecosystems of the planet. We got to be grappling over those things, but even as we do, everybody has got to be involved in building up this resistance. And I think there's really a tremendous need to put out a big call to masses of people, all kinds of people who are not activists, you know, who care about the environment. There's millions and millions of people like that. And we really got to put out a call to them to come into this struggle and to come into the struggle against all the different ways that the environment is being destroyed by this life-destroying system.
All right, Orpheus Reed, thank you very much, man. We'll have to have you back soon, okay?
Okay, man. Love to do it. Thanks so much, Michael.
All right, take care now. You're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and we've just been talking with Orpheus Reed, writer for Revolution Newspaper, who covers the environment, oil drilling, the Arctic, what's going on in the Arctic, all kinds of these environmental catastrophes caused by capitalism. We're going to take a quick musical break and be right back with Carl Dix talking about genocide, all right, the genocide of black people in this country and what's been happening recently and what the plans are for the future, all right? Welcome back. And if that didn't choke you up, get you angry, bring a tear to your eye, I don't know what will. Children singing about I am all these black people who have been murdered by the police and vigilantes and everything else by the system over the last period of time. It's a song by Robert Glasper, the Robert Glasper Trio, and it's called I'm Dying of Thirst. So check that out. It's a very, very moving song. The entire song is like that. I am. Little kids, I am. And there's a whole hell of a lot of truth to that. Well, I'm really happy to be welcoming back to the show Carl Dix, a representative of the Revolutionary Communist Party and a co-founder of the Stop Mass Incarceration Network. And he's going to be talking with us now. Both, we're going to start off talking about the racist, reactionary slaughter that went on in the church in South Carolina, what that portends, where it's coming from. And then we're going to move on and we're going to talk about a call that Carl Dix and Cornel West put out at a meeting just a few weeks ago calling for a huge national event, a march in New York City. And he'll tell us about it as we talk. Carl, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me on, Michael.
Sure. Carl, let's jump into this. Your thoughts on what went down in South Carolina.
Well, I mean, the first thing is just outrage. It's not thoughts, it is outrage. I mean, you walk into a church and you murder nine people engaged in Bible study, and you do it because they're black. That's all this came down to. And as he calmly reloads and explains to people why he has to do this, he spouts the racist lies that he has to do this because you are raping our women and taking over our country. This is America that he's doing this in, land that came into being on the basis of the theft of land from the native inhabitants and the genocide practiced against them back then, and from dragging millions of Africans to these shores in slave chains, subjecting them to brutal exploitation, savage brutality, and massive rape of the enslaved African women. And this is the racist dribble that spews out of his mouth. So this was an outrage. Then there's further outrage as it gets discussed, and essentially its real origins and what it means gets covered over in that discussion. You know, like, well, how could someone do something like this? Where could it have come from? Again, this is America, a country that white supremacy has flowed through its veins from the very beginning and continues to flow today, and that's where it came from. You know, so this was just a question of outrage upon outrage.
Mm-hmm. Tell me this, Carl. You know, when I was talking with you yesterday, I told you something that really affected me deeply as I was thinking about this and trying to, you know, just trying to, I'm not even going to try to say what I was trying to do, just trying to, you know, just take this in and what the hell, man? And I kept thinking about, you know, we've talked a lot about genocide and slow genocide and linked it up with the prisons and a murder by police. But, you know, there's a lot of other things in this society, including things like these attacks that in a place like this church where people were praying in a church that had like a huge history. It was very significant that he picked that church. It had a huge history of involvement in the fight against the oppression of black people going all the way back to Denmark Vesey. You know, and you think about this. There's a whole lot of stuff from the police kill rate I don't know what you call it, the kind of embrace of these killer mad dog cops standing on the hood of a car and shooting into, you know, 137 cops, you know, 137 bullets from all these cops standing around with one cowboy jumping on the hood of the car and shooting and killing these people. You know, all these things come up. You get all this stuff about this that all shows that when you take it in its entirety, it shows this genocide is a serious thing. Can we talk about this a little?
Yeah, exactly. And see, when you talk about this, people think you're engaging in hyperbole. No, we are analyzing the actual reality. I mean, the very way this system works has put tens of millions of black and Latino people in a situation where they are just about superfluous. You know, they can no longer profitably exploit their labor because the factories they used to exploit them in are halfway around the world because they can exploit someone in that part of the world even more viciously. And then their program for dealing with that is not retooling the economy to involve these people or retraining people for jobs in a newer economy, but a program of suppression and brutality, you know, mass incarceration, unleashing police terror. And that's what's going on. That's what we're up against here. And in addition to the official enforcers of that terror, you know, the police, the Border Patrol, and all of that, you have these unofficial enforcers like the George Zimmermans, you know, who murdered Trayvon Martin, like Michael Dunn, who murdered Jordan Davis. And now you've got Dylann Roof, the mass murderer in South Carolina. And it all flows from a thing that black lives do not matter in this society. That's the message that gets hammered at people again and again and again. And it's one that is completely unacceptable, that must not be accepted, that people need to reject, they need to stand up and fight. And what it's got to come down to is we need a revolution to get rid of this, because that's the only way that you can stop this slow genocide that sped up quite a bit Wednesday night and can speed up quite a bit, and all the other horrors that the system brings down, from the looming environmental disasters that you were just talking about to the attacks on women to the wars for empire, all of it. It's going to take revolution, nothing less, to get rid of it once and for all.
Let me remind listeners that you're tuned into the Michael Slate Show, and we're talking today with Carl Dix, a representative of the Revolutionary Communist Party and a co-founder, along with Cornel West, of the Stop Mass Incarceration Network. Now, tell me this, Carl, because this is going to be a real quick comment, I guess, actually. You know, the one thing that really got me to is what I was trying to say earlier is there's kind of it seems like there's a growing and expanding and deepening culture around this question of exactly what you said. Black lives, do they matter or do they not matter? And there's a culture growing up and expanding around black lives don't matter. And it's coming at us from many different ways. And it's shaping a bowl in which this savage genocide can be carried out in, you know?
Yeah, exactly. And let me just add that I issued a statement last night on this titled Outrage in Charleston, This is America. And people who want to check that statement out can go to the website revcom.us. That's revcom.us. But you're exactly right on this. There is an unleashing of a vicious anti-black people culture. And you see it even in things like Obama goes on Twitter. He gets on Twitter and there is an avalanche of just racist venom spewing his way, everything from calling black people monkeys to all of this stuff. And then you see that you have police officers, social media back and forth amongst each other gets exposed. And the same thing is going on there. And then they say, oh, this is our First Amendment right. We get to talk about the inhumanity of the people that we brutalize and even murder. And that's just free speech, and it has nothing to do with the disproportionate numbers of black and Latino people that we brutalize on the job, that we shoot down on the job, that we harass and arrest for BS and all of the rest. And see, that's the thing that this system has got people caught up in, because you've got that vicious, hard right, white supremacist, male supremacist stuff being unleashed. And then at the same time, people are told, well, if you don't like it, get behind the Democrats, who have no answer to that, especially on this front, because the argument between the left and the right is not over should this kind of savage brutality and murder be unleashed and backed up, but what's the best way to do it? Because you've got a Justice Department headed by a black man and now by a black woman. You've got a black president, a black head of Homeland Security, and a wave of police murder targeting mainly black and Latino people, and the Justice Department has done nothing.
Mm-hmm. Carl,
in the Obama presidency around that.
Yeah, absolutely. Very important. Carl, let me tell you this. We've got about 3.5 minutes, and I want you to make this. I want to ask you about this, the call you and Cornel West put out for Rise Up October, what it is, what it entails, and we'll have you back on the show to talk about it more in depth, but I want people to get a good sense of it now.
Yeah, that's a good segue, actually, because I talked about how there's no answer coming from the top around this problem of this wave of anti-black violence, especially police terror, but also mass incarceration and all the rest. Well, there needs to be, and there is, a growing response from among the people stepping up and saying, we're not going to take this. And a broad, widely felt determination to stop it. And this call that Cornell and I have issued is for a massive march in New York City on October 24th. Hundreds of thousands of people coming to New York City to shut it down, raising a very simple demand: stop police terror. And we're going to work to build this throughout the summer. We're going to draw a huge dividing line in society and say, which side are you on? Are you on the side of police killing black people, Latino people, and others and getting away with it? Or are you on the side of the people who are saying this is unacceptable, this must stop? That's the dividing line that we're going to draw, and we're going to challenge people to decide what side they stand on and to bring out to people that there is no middle ground here. Don't tell us that you're going to work to bring the police and the community together, because as long as the police are being unleashed to kill people and backed up by every level of government when they do it, there can be no togetherness. We're going to be mobilizing around this. We've already had a strategizing meeting. We've got a June 30th launch meeting for this coming up again in New York City. There's going to be announcements of a nationwide tour, regional meetings coming out of this June 30th meeting, and people need to pay very close attention to what gets announced, and they need to get involved, because it's going to take the efforts of everybody who sees these horrors for what they are and wants to see them stop to be a part of this. This ain't a Carl Cornell duo action. It's got to be an action of everybody who wants to see this stop. People need to go to the website, stopmassincarceration.net. That's stopmassincarceration, all one word, .net. And the website, revcom.us, that I mentioned before, for information about this, coverage of it as it developed, and most important, for how they can get involved and work to get other people involved. Because this has got to be everybody who wants this stopped getting to New York City and bringing a whole lot of other people to demand that this stop and to shut the city down in the course of raising that demand.
I'm getting a bigger car right now, okay? I'm going to still have a lot of people in. I'm going to be there. All right, Carl Dix, thank you very much for joining us today, and we'll have you back again real soon to continue this conversation, all right?
Thank you for having me on, Michael.
All right, take care. And we're going to take a quick musical break and be right back, so stay tuned. All right, all right. That's Little Richard. Little Richard, I tell you, how can you miss with that one? All right, Little Richard with "It Ain't What You Do, It's the Way How You Do It." All right, and that has everything to do with this next segment. About a week ago, I had the chance to talk with the Yes Men here in studio, and they are out pushing a new film they have out, which is called The Yes Men Are Revolting. And the Yes Men are two guys, Mike Bonanno and Andy Bicklebaum, and they're a duo of anti-corporate activist pranksters. Famous for, among other things, well, let me put it this way. They just impersonate all kinds of people. They get out and they put out the truth, things that seem really outlandish, but they're actually, when you look at it, it's like, God, this is really what, this is, they really get over with this stuff. They're really poking something at the system and the way it runs and all the havoc and horror that it's unleashing in the world. And they're really getting up in the face of the system and pointing out a whole different way. So I had a chance to talk with them and with Laura Nix, who is also part of the company and is the director of their film. Right now, we're going to go into that conversation, so check this out. All right, I'm really pleased to welcome to the show my next guest, Laura Nix, who's the director of a really great new film called The Yes Men Are Revolting. Also joining us is one of the Yes Men, Mike Bonanno. Mike, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much. Sure. Great to be here.
Laura, let's start with you. Why don't you tell people about the film? There's been other films about the Yes Men. This one seems to be a little bit different than the others. Let's talk about the film and why make this now.
Thanks for having me on the show, and The Yes Men Are Revolting is about two political activists who've been doing work collaborating together for almost 20 years, and they work on a number of issues. This time around, they're focusing on climate change, and they're basically like trying to tackle the biggest political issue they've ever faced, and they're doing that while it kind of coincides with somewhat of a midlife crisis, and it brings up this issue of like, how do we maintain hope and how do we keep going as activists as the years go by? And in the film, we kind of find out how they do it.
Mike, what made you want to make this film in particular?
Well, I think that, you know, we had made two other films in the past, The Yes Men and The Yes Men Fix the World, and we felt like we needed a third film to fill out a trilogy, and also we needed a film that did something different than the last two. We needed to really tell people a little bit more about who we are and what motivates us, and really the urgency of climate change is the other factor here. We felt like we really needed to roll up our sleeves and deal with this issue specifically because it kind of affects everything else. All other issues are tied to it.
And the thing that really motivated me this time around for this film is, in some ways, and this might sound ironic, but it's this idea of failure. And in the other two Yes Men films, you never saw them fail. You always saw them succeed. And the truth is, when these guys are doing this work, not every action gets pulled off. And rather than hide that, I felt like it was really important to show that process. Because that's actually what it's really like to be an activist right now, is that you do this work, you know, you go to the protests, you do the action, and guess what? At the end of the day, you didn't end racism that day, you didn't end poverty, you didn't solve climate change, and you have to get up and do something the next day anyways. And the Yes Men and the other two films can kind of come off as like superhuman in a way, like these activist superheroes who are going around the globe pulling off these actions, but they too have a lot of doubt. And I think that's what we all face. We wake up in the morning, we think about this huge problem like climate change, we think, oh my God, there's nothing we can do about that. And that's very human. And I thought it was important to share that the Yes Men have those doubts as well. That doubt that comes up is what it means to be a human on this planet right now. And they go through those questions themselves every day.
What do you think about that, Mike?
Yeah, I think that, I mean, we definitely found throughout the making of this film that we were making a film about regaining hope through finding others, and about balancing adult lives, lives where you have responsibilities and where you have to fit into all the dictates and mandates of capitalism, everything that comes with it, with doing this kind of activist work. And how, in the face of that, do you maintain hope, and do you actually see the long-term change that you are a part of when you join a movement? And so that really is what the film became about for us. I mean, we were living it. It was part of our lives over the last half decade.
One of the things that I was thinking about this morning is that, in a sense, it's not so much like we're going to go in and fix this, as much as it is you look at things the way you would want them to be and how you can expose the way they are, which is really, to me, one of the real strengths of your work. The reality that you want to be is what you're trying to speak to.
Yeah, well, there's two things that we do, two kind of modes that we operate in. One is dark satire. That is taking an idea to its logical extreme, like Jonathan Swift did in A Modest Proposal, where he suggested that the Irish eat their babies to solve their hunger problems. And that's like a classic example of satire. But another thing that we've done more and more over the years is announce the sort of dream, the solutions that we'd like to see. And we found that that ends up being very powerful. If you're impersonating somebody who people respect, who people really listen to, someone with a huge megaphone, somebody who's at the top of government or the top of the corporate ladder, suddenly you get people really buying in to those ideas. And in fact, not just buying in, but celebrating and getting excited. Instead of just accepting the bleak reality that we face, they get behind the idea. They mobilize. They even, as you'll see in our current film, get up and dance.
I was just going to ask you about that, because you have this concept of identity correction. And in that scene in particular, that seemed to come into play a lot, because it was just mind-blowing to see these people who were all with, what, they were with the Department of Homeland Security, and they're dancing a Native American dance.
Yeah, they're celebrating almost immediate conversion of the U.S. energy infrastructure to renewables. And they're doing it because the Department of Energy, who we are representing, is announcing that that is our new plan, and it's in the interest of Homeland Security. It makes sense. Climate change is a security issue. It's not just an environmental issue. It's an issue that affects all others. And so if we were to look at what we really should be doing for our planet's security and our country's security, we should be trying to address that. So it was an interesting venue to do it in, but all these people who are there, who are defense contractors, military people, they're all much more like us than a lot of people might think. I mean, when I say like us, I mean like me and Andy, you know, we're activists, but we actually, they are concerned about their kids. They are concerned about their future. They're concerned about the California drought. They're concerned about all of these things that we share together. And they're also people who are educated, and they know that we're facing this crisis. And so when given the opportunity to do what they know in their hearts to be right, they run for it. They're excited. They're ready to get up and dance, and they're ready to act on it. And so now we just need to push to make those changes the reality, because then everybody will line up behind it.
Laura, you were going to say something in relation to this?
That's kind of what the Yes Men do. The Yes Men basically impersonate voices of authority so that we start to think about how we listen to voices of authority and what we would like them to say that they're not saying, what it would be amazing for them to say in that case, or for us to be more critical of what they're saying. Because the truth is, if you turn on the radio or the TV and you listen to what a lot of these people are saying on a daily basis, it's insane. I mean, it's literally crazy. They're making decisions about our planet that are taking us to the brink of destruction. And we have to ask ourselves, why are these people there? And why are we allowing that to happen? I don't know how other people feel, but I feel like the sense of outrage that you can engage in on a daily basis about what's going on is so great. And the Yes Men are tapping into that. They want us to be able to think about what these people are saying, how they're saying it to us, and to engage in a more critical way with those voices.
Mike, I want to ask you, where do I get one of those survival balls?
Oh, well, you can look in our web store.
Okay.
Unfortunately, they're very, very expensive. They're only for the super rich. So if you're going to survive climate change in a Halliburton survival ball, the only way you can do it is by paying a tremendous, tremendous price.
Let's talk about the Chamber of Commerce. The U.S. Chamber of Commerce, you guys went in and you just appeared as somebody that they could look at and say, okay, yeah. And you could see in the audience when they're listening to the things that are outlandish. And they're looking at each other like, well, okay, but he does have authority. He is speaking to us. It's the projection of authority can make people believe a lot.
Yeah, I mean, the projection of authority, I mean, that is unfortunately the reality that we live in. I mean, there's some wonderful things about the way we are as humans, but one of the things that can get us into trouble is that we tend to respect authority and we tend to be gullible. You know, this has been proven in laboratory settings. And so when somebody announces that a very unusual or interesting thing, but they have authority to do it, then you tend to believe them. I mean, I do. In the case of the U.S. Chamber of Commerce announcement that we made, what we were announcing was actually not very unbelievable. It was that the U.S. Chamber of Commerce had changed their position and were getting behind climate legislation, legislation to limit emissions, which it's very sane. The difference is that what their policies at the time were completely bonkers. So actually having them decide to do something sane, I think, is kind of believable. In fact, everybody wants to believe it. When I say everybody, I mean most humans. I guess that's one of the things that makes projects like that really fly, is that when somebody hears it, they think, yeah, why not? Why isn't that happening? I'm excited that it is. I feel fulfilled. I feel like that aligns with what I need. And so, of course, we want to believe it.
You're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and I'm your host, Michael Slate, and we're talking today with Laura Nix, the director of the film The Yes Men Are Revolting, and Mike Bonanno, who's one of the Yes Men, and Andy Bickelman is the other one, and he has apparently disappeared in costume somewhere. Mike, you know, when you're talking about that, I was thinking about, okay, these things that people would want to believe, and you've had a lot of examples of things that people shouldn't believe, and I don't know who these people are, but we should round them up and help them somehow. The people who believed when you went on the George Bush stuff and told them to do what? You told them to sign a Patriot Pledge to keep nuclear waste in their backyard and send their children off to war. Did people actually sign that?
Oh, yeah, people definitely signed the Patriot Pledge. I mean, when we were out working for the Bush campaign in our own satirical way back in 2004, we had a lot of sort of jokey, kind of satirical interventions that we thought people would immediately recognize to be a joke, and that was going to be the fun of it. But it turned out that people were so polarized that they would just see the word Bush, and they would either immediately start screaming at us, or they would be willing to sign anything that we put in front of them. And so, actually, we found that that was one of those kind of strange failures where we completely misjudged what satire could do. The only people who actually really paused to think about it, it turned out, were people who didn't live in the United States, people who were visiting.
Well, there's the question for you. Were they the kind of people who could have gotten behind the action that you did that called on people to, what was it? It got people to agree to oppose anything that was being done for global warming because it wouldn't affect America that much while it would wipe out their competition around the world. That was pretty incredible when you think about people lining up to talk about that.
Yeah, I mean, at the time it was the result of a news story that came out about the military preparing for climate change and figuring out how it could play a strategic advantage in addition to how they would cope with it. And so we were playing off of that, and it was based very much in the sort of attitudes of the Bush-Cheney government at the time, which we thought were really missing the mark when it came to what we should be concerned about for the future of the country and the planet.
You know, one of the things that's really scary about that is that a long time ago when they were talking about developing that Star Wars technology and they were talking about nuclear war and it was really a threat of nuclear war, people grew up thinking that it was possible that there would be a nuclear war. And we're not talking like 100 years ago, 50 years ago. We're talking about in the 1980s. And they actually did a study. Congress did a study of, well, let's look at this concept of nuclear winter. Congress took a look at nuclear winter and they said, okay, maybe it's not that bad because maybe we can engineer a way where it would just affect our enemies and the people we don't like and leave us going good. And that's the kind of thing that is real. And it's kind of scary when you come so close to that in this type of stuff that you do.
Yeah, we often find that when we come up with our most outrageous satirical ideas, that they actually are in some way a reality already. I mean, I think back to one of the first times that we went and represented the World Trade Organization at an international trade law conference in Salzburg, and we came up with some pretty funny ideas, like we thought that we should talk about outlawing the siesta in Spain because it gets in the way of work. But it turns out that the Mexican government had already outlawed the siesta in government offices. So this idea of harmonization of business practices, outlawing sleeping at certain times of day, things like that, were already very much in the public domain.
Yes, Laura.
At one point, we were thinking about doing some kind of action that would involve children around oil and fracking. And we found these amazing videos that were online that had been created by one of the oil industry conglomerate, like think tanks. Mike, you'll remember the name of it. And they did these videos where they created these cakes for children that had different layers of cake and different colored frosting on all the different layers to show it being the earth and shale. And then they took straws and put it through to show them how fracking worked. And this is real. And you're looking at that going, this is the best joke thing I've ever seen. And we had to look at it countless times and try and get at the website multiple different ways because we couldn't believe that it was actually real. And that happens a lot when you do this kind of work, when you kind of really look at what kind of marketing and branding and crazy kind of work is being done by the PR companies that are hired by the fossil fuel companies to keep people thinking that this is the way to go. And the material they create is, if you want a good afternoon, you should just look at the websites of all those companies and look at some of the branded content that they make, because it's a blast.
Yeah, it's interesting. And it is. It's funny and it's horrifying because you're sitting there going, what the hell? People really believe this stuff. Mike, one more question about the past. One of the things you guys did was you put out a fake issue of the New York Times, playing on all the news that's fit to print. You did all the news we'd like to print. And it sort of says something about the envelope that your whole project takes part in, that it's part of, is this sort of what we would want to see happen in terms of, again, going at it from a different kind of angle. It does go at it from exposing the horror in it, but actually you have to slap people in the head every now and then to get them to wake up. And when they do, it's like, whoa, what the hell's going on here?
Yeah, I mean, I think that we have to slap ourselves in the head to wake ourselves up, because we're all part of this culture of capitalism that privileges profit and growth, short-term profit and growth, over everything else. And a lot of the times we do these things to just wake ourselves up, you know? It's not so much about even waking other people up. It's about thinking about the alternatives that are there and exercising that muscle in our minds that has become so dormant, these muscles of imagining these futures that are not just possible, but attainable. I mean, conversion to renewable energy, there are lots of people saying we can't do it, but the fact is that a lot of places are doing it, and they're doing it well, and they're doing it quickly. And the fact that we're not doing it in the U.S. at those speeds is a real shame. I mean, it can happen. And so presenting those so-called utopian alternatives, but attainable ones, I think is super important, and that's why we keep doing it.
And we're really encouraging other people to get involved in creative activism as well and realize that this kind of activism doesn't require superhuman strength or financing. You can do it too. There's one action in the film that takes place during Occupy Wall Street, and it's just done with some suits and pizza boxes and markers. It was conceived of and happened in a matter of hours. So some of the actions are really elaborate, but some of them are really simple. And we've started a digital platform called the actionswitchboard.net. And we're hoping that people join that. It hooks you up with activists all over the world who want to do this kind of activism. So if you're launching something in the Ukraine and you need computer programming, maybe somebody in Helsinki wants to help you out. Or maybe you're really concerned about fracking in North Dakota and there's somebody who's really excellent at graphics who lives in London and they want to support you. So it's a way of connecting all these kinds of people who want to work on this kind of creative activism all over the globe. And we're hoping that it gets the energy going.
Mike, one last question. And the point you just made about you have to smash through in a certain sense, you have to break down all the barriers to people actually acting in the interest of humanity. And I think that's something that you've really become very skilled at. You get people's heads in a whiplash sometimes when you do this stuff, and people get the humor, but they come out of it questioning the way that they were thinking. And if we're going to have a change, and I'm a revolutionary, and I really think that one of the key factors is you have to change the way that people think in terms of how they confront the problems of the day, how they go from accepting things or thinking that we're accepting them just because we can't do anything about it, to actually challenging the whole setup.
Yeah, well, that's very much why we also deal with big issues in our films. You know, we have the luxury of doing that in a way because we are not the type of activists that need to make incremental policy changes. I mean, most organizations that are trying to do things like lobby and change laws and actually influence policy very directly have to look at to deal with things at a certain level of minutia to make those incremental gains. And that's super important. And those are the kinds of things that we can support with our actions, you know, which are about focusing public attention on those goals and trying to raise awareness, get more press for these things, and then to deal with the big issues, the systemic problems that we face, because that is right at the core of it. You know, we have a system that is based on ideas like interest, that's based on the ideas like profit and growth. I mean, we need to grow 3% per year, or we go into recession and things collapse. Well, it's pretty obvious that there's an end game there, and we have a finite planet with finite resources. There are ways that you can grow without consuming very much, but it's still a problem. You're still consuming something. So we need to look at those issues and deal with it on a really big scale, and that's a challenge, and that's part of what our movie is about. It's about looking at those challenges and saying, well, how do we get there as activists? How do we put pressure on governments to get to those goals?
All right, Mike Bonanno, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Laura Nix, thank you.
Thank you.
And I have been talking with Laura Nix, the director of the film The Yes Men Are Revolting, and Mike Bonanno, one half of The Yes Men. Just one more thing, Laura. Tell people when the movie is playing and where.
So the movie is opening up around the country in select cities. And if you go to our website, theyesmenarerevolting.com, and go to watch the film, you'll see a list of screenings. We're starting in New York and L.A. and then going out to about 30 cities around the country. And we are also currently available on iTunes, all digital platforms, and on demand. So you can really get the film anywhere in North America if you hook up to the net.
And the Yes Men who have brought us to Yes, the end of yet another show. And I want to really thank all of you for joining us today. I also want to thank all of my guests today, Orpheus Reed, Carl Dix, Laura Nix, and the Yes Men. And I also want to thank my assistant producer, Henry Carson, my production assistant, Jeff Pryor, my board op for today, Federico Garcia, always amazing Federico Garcia. And I want to thank each and every one of you for tuning in. If you want to write to me, you can at michaelslate@redfuture.com. Again, and slower, that's michaelslate@redfuture.com. And if you write, I will answer, okay? If you write and tell me what you're thinking, I will answer and tell you what I'm thinking. So go ahead and do it. Love to hear from you. And we're going to go out now with something that I've really been fond of for quite a bit of time, and I just picked it up again and realized that, hey, this is a great song to go out on. And it's from Alabama 3, and it's a track sometimes called Flag and sometimes called Woody Guthrie. Check this out.
Another psychopath in Iowa, loading up another round, while the NRA and Columbine hunt Marilyn Manson down. Powder in the Pentagon, crew letters in the mail, some KKK white supremacist cooking up a dose of race hate. I tell you now, I don't need no country, I don't fly no flag, I cut no slack for the Union Jack. Stars and stripes got me jet black, yeah. I don't need no country, I don't fly no flag, I cut no slack for the Union Jack. Stars and stripes got me jet black, yeah. So baby in Afghanistan, Crown Force mama now, while the BMP scare refugees senseless up in Oldham Town. Hypocrites in Downing Street pouring petrol on the flames. Sabto cries, asks Patty, why do we always get the blame? I tell you now, I don't need no country.